Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Jill Robbins, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
At an animal hospital in the Northeast United States, a biologist takes blood from a sick loggerhead sea turtle named Honeybun. This is one of the first steps scientists must take before treating and rehabilitating the turtle so that it can be returned into the wild. Cape Cod, in the state of Massachusetts, may have some of the largest numbers of turtle strandings in the world. The number of turtles that became trapped on Cape Cod beaches has risen over the past 10 years. That information comes from the Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. This year, volunteers found 829 turtles washed up on the sand. About half of them were dead, including some that were frozen solid. That number is nearly twice what workers found in 2016 and nearly 10 times more than 2008. Some experts think the number of washed-up turtles is related to climate change. A paper published in PLOS ONE notes that there were more strandings of Kemp's Ridley sea turtles in years with warmer sea surface temperatures. It added that, of the threats to turtle populations, climate change may present the broadest threat for sea turtle conservation. Over the past 10 years, many turtles have been moving north from the Gulf of Mexico into the warming waters of the Gulf of Maine. There, they feed on mussels, crabs, and other sea creatures. Cape Cod extends into the Atlantic Ocean, serving as a kind of trap for turtles. When the waters cool there, the animals start to have health problems, like developing pneumonia. They have problems moving and eating. Bob Prescott is the director of Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary and helped to prepare the PLOS ONE paper. He notes that the sea turtles know how to leave, but the Cape is like a trap, a hook within a hook. If the turtles survive, it can take months before they are fully recovered. Adam Kennedy is a biologist at New England Aquarium's Sea Turtle Hospital in Quincy, Massachusetts. He says that when the turtles arrive at the hospital, they look like they are dead, especially in December. Other experts argue that climate change alone cannot explain the increased number of turtle strandings. Jeffrey Seminoff heads the Marine Turtle Ecology and Assessment Program at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Marine Fisheries Service. He believes that the high number of strandings probably results from the simple fact that there's more turtles. Seminoff said that the recovery of the turtle population and success of conservation efforts at the nesting beaches could explain the higher number of turtle strandings. Kennedy, the biologist, said that he has mixed feelings when the turtles are released back into the wild. It's bittersweet because you spend so much time with them, but ultimately every one of these guys getting back to the ocean helps the population. Recently, Honeybun, the turtle we met at the beginning of our report, and other turtles were taken to Florida. They were released into the water. Kelly Schaefer is with National Aquarium Baltimore, which worked with four other groups to organize the turtles' release. She noted that she feels a sense of joy and accomplishment at being able to put them back out there. I'm John Russell.
Tall dinosaurs stand among unusual-looking plants on the grounds around a California home. A statue of cartoon character Fred Flintstone stands near the front door and welcomes visitors. Nearby sits a large sign painted in orange, purple, and red. It reads, "Yabba Dabba Doo," the words Flintstone made famous in his 1960s television show. In a pricey neighborhood outside San Francisco, there is a battle between government rules and property rights. A retired publisher has built a home that honors the Flintstones. There are Stone Age statues that look like animals from the show, along with space creatures and other strange things. International media are following the dispute. Thousands of people have signed an online petition to save the property, which can be seen from a nearby road. Florence Fong's 832 square meter house is not at risk. It is the grounds around it that the town of Hillsboro says must change. The property is not as nice looking as the neighboring properties, say the officials. Last month, they went to court to make her remove the garden statues. Fong does not live in the house, but uses it for parties. Angela Aliotto, a former San Francisco supervisor, is the lawyer for the 84-year-old owner. Aliotto says the officials want to take away Fong's right to enjoy her yard and promises an intense fight. Mrs. Fong has made people smile. She's giving them joy. "What's not to love about Dino, who acts like a dog?" said Aliotto. "What is wrong with these people?" The unusually shaped house, currently painted red and purple, was built in 1976. Fong, who once published the San Francisco Examiner, bought the property in June 2017 for $2.8 million. Lawyer Mark Hudak is representing the town of Hillsboro. He says the town prides itself on its rural, woodsy feel. He added that rules are in place so neighbors don't have to look at your version of what you would like to have, and you don't have to look at theirs. She still has to go through the process like everyone else. Officials say Fong did not follow the town's stop work orders. She also ignored an order to remove the statues by last December 5th. She did pay a $200 fine, however. Tim Iglesias is a property professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law. He said the owner has ignored the government rules again and again. If they let her get away, then all the other wealthy people in Hillsboro can say, "Hey, I can do whatever I want with my property." Who cares about the planning department? I'm Jill Robbins.
Scientists say two rare water frogs had a long-awaited first date and showed signs of mating, which could help save the species. The two are critically endangered Sahuencas water frogs, native to Bolivia. The male, named Romeo, was considered the last known living member of the species when he was collected from the wild 11 years ago. But that changed in January, when researchers announced that five additional Sahuencas water frogs had been found. That discovery was made by researchers from Global Wildlife Conservation and Bolivia's Alcide d'Orbigny Natural History Museum. The find came after the team increased its search activities in an urgent effort to find a mate for Romeo. Bolivia has a large number of amphibian species, but Global Wildlife Conservation reports that 22% of them, including 10 of 14 kinds of water frogs, face serious threats of disappearing from the planet. Experts blame several causes for the decrease in numbers, including destruction of habitat, the introduction of non-native species, climate change, and a deadly disease called chytridiomycosis. Among the five newly discovered frogs were three females, one of which was identified as a possible ideal partner for Romeo. Scientists named her Juliet. After months of observation at the Natural History Museum, officials confirmed that Juliet was free of disease. Then, on March 1st, she and Romeo were put into a tank that was new to both of them. After more observation, museum officials decided to move Juliet into Romeo's former tank. They believed the move would improve conditions for mating. Teresa Camacho Badani works with amphibians at the museum. She said in a statement that officials believed it was important to begin the mating process right away. When the fate of an entire species is on the line, there's really no time for taking it slow before committing to moving in together. She added, Romeo has been really sweet to Juliet. For example, the male frog has been following her around the tank and sacrificing some of his food to her, Badani said. After he's been alone for so long, it's wonderful to see him with a mate. Finally, museum officials say one of the first hopeful signs was a change in Romeo's calling behavior. He had not been heard making calling sounds since the end of 2017. But he started making the noises again shortly after the pair got moved into Romeo's tank. Since meeting Juliet, Romeo has also been doing something that experts say has never been seen before in this species group. Romeo has been observed quickly moving the toes on his back feet when he's near Juliet. The experts say this species-specific performance is likely an attempt by the male to impress the female.
Although there are signs that Romeo is interested in mating, Badani says he still has some things to learn. The museum reports that so far he has gotten himself in the correct mating position only a few times for a few minutes. The mating process involves the male frog holding the female in a certain way long enough to fertilize her eggs. Generally, mating can only be successful when both frogs stay in position for weeks or even months. But wildlife experts admit they know very little about the reproductive behavior of this species. Chris Jordan is head of Global Wildlife Conservation's operations in Central America and the tropical Andes. He said in a statement that it is not known how long the mating process would last for Cehuenchus frogs. His team is also not sure how long the eggs would take to develop or how many might be produced. For now, we're keeping them together and observing them, he said, which, as simple as it sounds, is already revealing previously unknown behaviors and answering natural history questions about this relatively unknown species. Jordan added that the experiment was another example of how little we know about a lot of the species with which we share this planet. The public can follow Romeo and Juliet's progress on Facebook. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Theodore Roosevelt became President of the United States at the beginning of the 20th century. It was a time of great technological progress in the United States. Yet many people felt that there was too little social progress. They demanded reforms in politics, industry, and the use of natural resources. Theodore Roosevelt supported this call for reforms. His first target was big business. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of the presidency of Teddy Roosevelt.
In the early 1900s, a group of wealthy American businessmen agreed to join their railroads. They formed a company or trust to control the joint railroad. The new company would have complete control of rail transportation in the American West. There would be no competition. President Roosevelt believed the new company violated the Sherman antitrust law. The law said it was illegal for businesses to interfere with trade among the states. Roosevelt said he would make no compromises in enforcing the law. He asked the Supreme Court to break up the railroad trust. "We are not," Roosevelt said, "attacking these big companies. We are only trying to do away with any evil in them. We are not hostile to them, but we believe they must be controlled to serve the public good."
The Supreme Court ruled against the railroad trust. In the next few years, other trusts would be broken up in the same way. The American people called this trust busting, and they called Theodore Roosevelt the trust buster. Roosevelt made several speeches explaining his position on big business. Everywhere he went, he found wide public support. Later, he told a friend why people liked him so well. He said, I put into words what is in their hearts and minds, but not in their mouths.
President Roosevelt won even more public support for his actions during a labor crisis in the coal industry. The incident was one of many in American history in which a president had to decide if he should interfere in private industry. Coal miners went on strike in the spring of 1902. They demanded more pay and safer working conditions. Mine owners refused to negotiate. One even insulted the miners. He said, "The rights and interests of the laboring man will be protected and cared for. It will not be the labor activists who take care of him. It will be the Christian men to whom God, in his great wisdom, has given the control of the property interests of this country." This self-serving use of religion made many Americans support the striking workers.
After several months, President Roosevelt invited coal mine owners and union leaders to a meeting in Washington. He asked them to keep in mind that a third group was involved in their dispute, the public. He warned that the nation faced the possibility of a winter without heating fuel. Roosevelt said, "I did not call this meeting to discuss your claims and positions. I called it to appeal to your love of country." The union leaders said they were willing to have the president appoint an independent committee to settle the strike. They said they would accept the committee's decision as final. The mine owners rejected the idea. One warned the president not even to talk about it. Such talk, he said, was illegal interference in private industry.
That made Theodore Roosevelt angry. Later, he said, "If it were not for the high office I held, I would have taken him by the seat of the pants and the nape of the neck and thrown him out the window." Finally, Roosevelt got both sides to agree to a compromise. Mine owners agreed to have an independent committee study the miners' demands, and the miners agreed to return to work until the study was completed. Several months later, the report was ready. The committee proposed that miners accept a smaller pay increase in exchange for improved working conditions. Both sides accepted the proposal. The coal strike ended.
Not everyone was happy. Many people still felt Roosevelt had no right to interfere. Roosevelt disagreed. "My business," he said, "is to see fair play among all men, capitalists or wage workers. All I want to do is see that every man has a fair deal, no more, no less." Roosevelt believed the United States needed a strong leader. He planned to strengthen the presidency whenever he could. Roosevelt was an active, noisy man. As one writer described him, "Theodore is always the center of action. When he goes to a wedding, he wants to be the bride. When he goes to a funeral, he wants to be the dead man." Many of Roosevelt's friends thought he was an overgrown boy. "You must always remember," one said, "that the president is about 6 years old." Another friend sent this message to Roosevelt on his 46th birthday. "You have made a very good start in life. We have great hopes for you when you grow up."
Theodore Roosevelt loved outdoor activities. He especially loved the natural beauty of the land. He worried about its future. Roosevelt wrote, "I recognize the right and duty of this generation to develop and use the natural riches of our land, but I do not recognize the right to waste them, nor to rob, by wasteful use, the generations that come after us." Roosevelt set aside large areas of forest land for national use. He created 50 special areas to protect wildlife, and he established a number of national parks.
Theodore Roosevelt faced the responsibilities of foreign policy with the same strength he used in facing national problems. He firmly believed in expanding American power in the world. "We have no choice," he said, "as to whether or not we will play a great part in the world. All that we can decide is whether we will play our part well or poorly." To play well, Roosevelt said, the United States needed a strong navy. It also needed a canal across Central America so the navy could sail quickly between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans.
For many years, people had dreamed of such a waterway. With a canal across Central America, ships could sail directly from ocean to ocean. They would not have to make the long, costly voyage around the southern end of South America. The most likely place to build such a canal was at the thinnest point of land, Panama. Another possible place was just to the north, Nicaragua. Over the years, several attempts were made to build the canal.
In the 1880s, Ferdinand de Lesseps, builder of the Suez Canal, formed a French company to build a waterway across Panama. De Lesseps spent $300 million to build just one-third of the canal. He could get no more money. His company failed. In the 1890s, an American company tried to build a canal across Nicaragua. It made little progress. After 3 years, it gave up the attempt. When Theodore Roosevelt became president in the early 1900s, he was ready to try again.
A study was made to decide which would be a better place for the canal, Panama or Nicaragua. Engineers said it would cost less to complete the canal de Lesseps had started 20 years earlier in Panama. But de Lesseps' company still owned the land on which the canal would be built. The United States would have to buy the land as well as the rights to build the waterway. The study decided it would be less costly overall to build the canal in Nicaragua. The proposal went to the United States Congress for approval.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.